Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest on the Congress's super committee, the co-chairs of which just announced their failure to come to an agreement. Economist and professor of political science at Boston University, Thomas Ferguson, joins us to analyze the bad deal that became no deal because Republicans not only refused to budge on the Bush tax cuts and agree to a modest increase from 35% to 39% for the richest Americans, they actually wanted to cut taxes for the 1% even further. We'll discuss what might come next for a government of the 1%, by the 1%, and for the 1%. Then we'll look into the results of the elections in Spain with the deputy editor-in-chief of Spain's largest newspaper, El País. Antonio Cano joins us to explain the resounding victory by the Conservatives, who are promising more austerity for the Eurozone's fourth largest economy that has 45 out of 100 young Spaniards out of work and feeling indignant. Then finally, we will discuss the renewed demonstrations in Tahrir Square, Egypt, where many protesters now feel they quit the Arab Spring protests too soon and handed the revolution to the military, which has shown an unwillingness to cede control. The former chair of the Political Science Department at Cairo University, Sheila Carapico, joins us to discuss what will make the generals give up power and return to their barracks. Joining us now is Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and a senior fellow of the Roosevelt Institute. He's a member of the advisory board of George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor for The Nation. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi there.
And the super committee, of course, is a less than super performance here.
Yeah, it looks like they just sort of got enmeshed in kryptonite.
So do you think there are two questions that come out of it? One, whether this trigger, this so-called sequester, will actually happen? I mean, actually, that's the real question. I mean, the threat of the sequester has kept their feet to the fire. Clearly, that hasn't made a difference because they've not agreed and compromised in any way. So what's your expectation that this mechanism will actually come into play? Because they have a whole year till 2013.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, these guys wrote themselves a whole year. They're experienced folks. They knew exactly what they were doing. My take is that it's very unlikely they'll do that. Across-the-board cuts of that type are so stupid that, you know, even the U.S. Congress is unlikely to try to implement it. You can see, I mean, Senator Lindsey Graham and Joe Lieberman at one point were talking about bringing in a bill to not do the military cuts. And, you know, frankly, it's about time somebody brought in a bill on the Democratic side not to do the civilian cuts. I mean, the way that bill is written, it exempts Social Security and Medicare, and I would hastily add, as it should, from cuts. I mean, we can talk a little later about what they should have done, particularly on Medicare, but Social Security never belonged in that discussion at all. But given that it exempts those programs, then the cuts would effectively wipe out the rest of the civilian budget. You know, research and development, education, all kinds of stuff. It's just ridiculous. And, no, I don't think they'll do it. I hope they won't. And, you know, this is just one trusts a sort of way station on a road that leads to nowhere.
But so far, the dynamic, at least as much as we know from these deliberations of the super committee, the dynamic has been that the Democrats have made concessions and the Republicans have refused and drawn a line in the sands on not yielding one inch on the Bush tax cuts.
That's right. No, and, you know, often the Democratic offers have been insane, too. I mean, in some cases, you know, back in the summer, they reached about 9-1 in terms of cuts versus tax rise, and it still wasn't enough for the Republicans.
Well, should we therefore be grateful, Tom Ferguson, that the Republicans are so intransigent?
Well, not entrenched, but, I mean, let us say fixed on that purpose. Yeah, this is remarkable enough that it merits a comment. You know, the polls, everybody's polls, have about Americans by about a 2-1 margin wanting tax rises on the rich. And by 4-1 or more margins, they don't want cuts in either Social Security or Medicare. And nevertheless, you know, even a majority of Republicans don't want those cuts. And even a majority of Republicans want taxes to rise on the rich. You know, but the Republicans just sit there. You know they're not responding to popular pressure. I'm sorry to be a broken record, but it is perfectly obvious that they are responding to their contributors.
And they're also responding to the blackmail from Grover Norquist, aren't they? He threatens to run well-heeled candidates against them in the primaries if they in any way give up on their no-tax pledge.
Norquist is actually quieting down, I think, at the moment. Norquist is simply a symbol here, but, I mean, Norquist is basically one more agent by which political money flows against people in Congress not to raise taxes. He's not interesting in his own right, frankly, there. I mean, one could as well pick on the Club for Growth, although both of those, they've all been starting to make funny little curlicues in recent weeks because the position is so crazy that it is clearly now impinging even on the Republican presidential chances. And there are an awful lot of people in the party, including a fair number of wealthy contributors, that think they're going off the deep end. But yeah, I mean, singling out one person for this is, you're looking at a wall of money. It's a big one.
So this is really about the power of the oligarchy through its whores and hirelings in the Congress to get its way. And it indicates in the most stark sense then how much the 1% control this country.
Yes, and I would add, you know, that the Democrats make these ridiculous offers is another way of underscoring that point. Yeah, I mean, you've got, you know, this is now a battle between Tweedledee and Tweedledum, which is both of which are very far from what the American public wants. And nobody's polls are coming up with anything different. I mean, this is the clearest cut case you'll ever see of essentially a broken political system.
Well, Tom Ferguson, this is a system, at least in terms of the polling of the Congress, the approval ratings now stand at 9%. And frankly, I wonder who that 9% are.
Yeah, it's the same old Nixon question. I used to ask myself who the 21 or 23% were. Yeah, I know what you mean. It'd be fun to see what it does in the next couple days. Maybe they can actually finally get to zero, though I doubt it.
But Tom Ferguson, again, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and a senior fellow of the Roosevelt Institute, the market still has responded. So if this is Tweedledum and Tweedledee and Kabuki Theater and was destined to fail and all of the above, how come the market is tanking then?
No. Look, I doubt that the market tanking today has anything at all to do with this. This one has been long anticipated. What you have instead, if you notice, the European markets tanked even on mostly bigger. And that there is plainly responding to the broader euro problem. And, I mean, we've talked about this before on other shows. I mean, this hurricane is finally coming on shore, and it threatens both Europe and the United States. And you don't need any it's not like people weren't warned that this, I don't think anybody entertained big hopes for deficit reduction. This is about the euro story here, which is a really serious issue. And you see today also a big bevy of recession forecasts. And that's, you know, that's going to be disastrous for stock markets. I mean, you know, if it were, you know, if Europe were up and the U.S. were down, you'd have a point. That's not what you see. Europe is down even more.
So, Tom Ferguson, does that mean in a political context that President Obama's re-election fate is in the hands of Angela Merkel?
Possibly, yep. And one could add, that's a little unfair. Angela Merkel, yes, is one possibility. You know, we could add Nicolas Sarkozy and a few other folks in there. But, yeah, I mean, there's no question that the European thing is a huge threat.
So, Tom Ferguson, what is your explanation for the European leaders' two-year-long dithering and apparent fecklessness? And as this crisis deepens with the eurozone, the cost to getting out of it grows. So for pennies on the dollar, they should have and could have solved this years ago.
My take is, if you look at the domestic political situations in those countries, they strongly resemble the U.S. with sometimes some important differences that are irrelevant to this particular outcome. That is to say, everybody's into austerity mode, and they have been like that since the Toronto summit or before. The Germans, you know, had switched out onto that too. And everybody's tax collections are off, and everybody's being pressed by domestic political competitors, and so they're all scared to move. You know, the Germans in particular, you know, it's a fairly tense political situation there. You know, I don't know that you need much more to explain that than that. Aunt Merkel's own coalition, every time she makes some move toward a euro bailout, her coalition partner, the Free Democrats, starts either criticizing her in public or even talking openly about pulling out. That's not a nice prospect if you're German chancellor.
So, Tom Ferguson, we're going to be speaking with a veteran reporter with El País, which is the largest Spanish newspaper in the world and the largest in Spain, about the Spanish elections. But is that a harbinger, the fact that Spain went to the right? I mean, with 45 out of 100 young Spaniards out of work, I'm not surprised they kicked the government out.
Well, I've been saying for a while, and I think I even said it on your program some months ago, that Greece and Spain show everybody else the way of their future, in the sense that popular discontent is enormous with these high unemployment rates. And, you know, what really happened is Spain didn't move so much as to the right as it went from the ins went out and the outs came in. I mean, you're getting this sort of deadly cycle of in, out, out, in. And in every country, as this persists, just as in the Great Depression, you get weirder and weirder politics that begins to develop. You're now in the morbid stage. You can see the, if you like, politics polarizing on both the left and the right. That's clearly happening even in the U.S. with the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street. And, you know, the truth is the population in the U.S. detests both of its major political parties. Nobody likes Obama very much. They like him better than they like Republicans, because admittedly, well, some of these people are really rather strange. But, you know, even the Republicans don't like most of the Republicans. So this is a very odd environment, and it's going to get a lot odder. The politics of austerity are really very unpleasant, and we haven't had a real dose of it since the 1930s. We are getting it now.
Well, but how did the politics of austerity overcome the reality of Keynesianism, if you will? Because there aren't any other alternatives, are there, to stimulate when you have a recession? And I don't understand how the politics of austerity, which are so counterintuitive to the moment, have taken such a grip.
Well, I mean, I actually don't have trouble with this, but I may be in some peculiar state of mind all my own. I mean, the issue here is relatively simple. All of the no new tax sentiment that's a pretty popular cause internationally. I mean, despite, you know, you see efforts around to generate popular support among millionaires for a rise in taxes. That's a decided minority in every country. And as I have, you know, often said to folks, the evidence is it's conclusive in the case of a fair number of countries. The U.S. wasn't involved in some of the studies, but it's clear that the financial community, notably banks, ever since 2007, when you do general budgetary reflation, bank stocks fall unless the money's intended for them. And that's a very interesting result that comes out of some papers. And what that warns you is that a lot of folks think they're, in effect, in a zero-sum world. So an awful lot of folks the simplest explanation to say that a lot of folks don't believe in Keynes. You get huge numbers of folks pushing some older form of either classical economics or some pre-Keynesian approach. And, you know, they just think the way you respond to these problems is to have the confidence fairy summoned by cutting everything.
But Thomas Ferguson, if the Europeans are unhappy with their taxes, at least they get something back for their taxes.
They get some services.
And
case, there's no question that the desire to roll back the social welfare state has gripped big chunks of the business community there. And you also have in Europe, rather more than in the U.S., some fears that you could have a resurgence of unionism. Both of those tend to push people toward austerity.
But in the United States, the anti-tax jihad is being funded by the billionaires and the oligarchs. And Grover Norquist, as we discussed earlier, is their hireling.
Well, we don't have direct evidence on it. Most of his stuff is not public. He doesn't have to make it public. But I do know some people who've contributed to him, and I can say that lobbyists for some of the largest banks in the world have certainly in the past contributed to him.
Well, I rest my case. I mean,
but this is fundamentally my case. I mean, what don't we understand at that point?
Right, but I don't understand why the Democrats accede to this argument and why
they're dependent on big money too. And none of these folks want to pay very much in taxes. At best, you get, all right, we can take back some of our giant gains, but that's a minority sentiment. It's a minority even in the Democratic end of the thing.
But what is a majority sentiment by a vast percentage?
The polls are one thing, the super rich are another. I mean,
well,
look,
that's the point.
This is a 1% versus 99% issue, Ian. The long and the short of it.
But if you're in politics and you want to get votes, and if it's very popular with the majority to tax the super rich who are getting away with absolute
look, my friend,
free.
I have a book on this. It's called Golden Rule, and there you find the principle of non-competition across all interests when they agree, all moneyed interests. If nobody will put up the money to make that appeal, even if the whole population wants it and everybody knows it, it doesn't happen. And it's not happening.
So
can't finance the appeal, okay? So, I mean, it's just that's the long and the short of it. It's expensive to campaign. It's more expensive than in classical Democratic theory. People sort of think money grows on trees or something. It doesn't.
Well, Tom Ferguson, we have an election year coming up. It's about a year from now.
I'm shocked.
God help us, the billions are going to be spent.
Yep.
Will this then, given the crisis in Europe, which they don't seem to be getting their hands on, if that spills over to here and billions are going to be spent by, I guess, Romney will be fronting, do you think?
Well, that hasn't been any election yet. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, it looks to me, and by the way, one of the great paradoxes of elections are that these billions that congressmen and senators raise and they sell their souls in the process, most of that money's turned over to the oligopolies in the media. So they're the real winners in this thing.
Well, yes, although if you limited it campaign spending, a lot of the media have figured out that they'd have even more power. That's one reason a fair number of them have supported some of that stuff. I mean, yeah, it's a complex question. That's well worth exploring some other time.
Well, but the other paradox is that all this money is only spent on about 20% of the electorate, the so-called swing votes.
Yep.
And as you get closer to the election, all of the money is being spent on about 3-6% who are the undecided. And if you're undecided by late October of 2012, you are in a category of indifferent, ignorant, people who don't.
It's a famous result. Yeah, it goes back to the earliest polls, even from the 1940 election. Yes.
The stupidest people are the ones they're spending the money on.
Well, let's be careful.
Well, or the least engaged, the least informed.
I'm very careful about that judgment. I mean, a lot of folks are, you know, they're not connected. They don't read the web, or they've simply given up on the political system. You know, that.
Yeah, I stand corrected.
Well, wonder who's really stupid.
No, I stand corrected. Anyway, Thomas, it's good to talk to you. I wish we had better news, but that's the way it is. Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Tom Ferguson.
Sure, thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with Tom Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Boston and a senior fellow of the Roosevelt Institute. He's a member of the advisory board of George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor for The Nation. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the deputy editor of El País, the largest Spanish newspaper in the world.
You got my heart, you got my soul, you got the silver, you got the gold, you got the diamonds from the mine. Well, that's all nice. And buy some time.